see.
Mamandule watched with delight as lightning struck the Gula, killing them. Flash, crackle, drop. Flash, crackle, flame. Over and over, the storm delivered an unnatural series of killer bolts that left him seeing after streaks. These runes did not wear the special armor, and strike after strike, the lightning killed. While dozens of bolts fired at the same time, there were still thousands and thousands of Gula charging at them. Big, hairy brutes with spears and rough wooden shields. Clearly, the fray could easily kill several hundred, but then be slaughtered by the rest.
How can there be so many? They're like rats!
His father realized the danger as well.
Anya, create a firewall.
A firewall? Why?
A moment later, as the barbarians threw themselves into a wailing run, a 10-foot wall of flame appeared between the Gula and the last cohort of Shadi. This flaming fence began in the middle of the field, then rapidly ran out to either side. Mawandule didn't understand why the spiders didn't just blast the savages with torrents of flame. Their strategy became clearer as the wall began to move. It curled around, driving the Gula west toward the Burn River, toward the cliff.
Fire the bridges!
In a few seconds, fire appeared on all seven of them.
Mawandule, have you become deaf or just stupid? Answer me. What are you seeing?
Jared had asked the same question every few minutes since the battle started. At first, Mawandule had complied, whispering descriptions, but he grew tired of narrating. He found the process irritating and demeaning. He hadn't invited Jared to sit in his head that morning and felt no obligation to relay information like some courier.
Push them off the cliff.
Not too fast. A slow and steady creep. I want them to have the opportunity to ponder their fate. Give them time to choose between jumping to their death or burning alive.
The Fane picked up his wine once more and sat down. He swirled the contents in the cup.
This is the way my mother used to do it.
Show them what it means to go to war against the Miralith.
He stared out at the thousands beyond the wall of fire that marched unerringly forward.
This is your reward.
He gestured to the servant to fill another cup.
Have some wine, Mawandule. I don't like to drink alone.
His father was in a dark but generous mood, at least toward him. Mawandule didn't answer. The sight and the anticipation were fascinating. An unrelenting wall of fire drove more people than he'd ever seen in one place toward a sheer drop. A few runes tried to run through. He saw them catch fire and fall. When the wall moved past, he could see their scorched bodies, lumps in a smoking black field. As the wall pressed, those caught inside were squeezed. Those in the rear, row by row, line by line, began to slip into the chasm. Sign pointed up at the sky.
It's coming.
What is?
Valat!
Mawandule looked toward the fortress and spotted the dark winged creature coming at them. The dragon that had breathed fire was getting larger by the second, and Mawandule already thought it was pretty big.
Sign, use lightning. Kill it.
Lightning crackled, and a jagged finger of blue-white light struck the beast. It didn't even dip with the impact, didn't fall. It barely altered its flight. Again and again, Sign jolted the dragon with bolts. The thing kept coming.
Damn you, Mawandule. What are you seeing?
The art has no effect on it.
No effect? That doesn't make sense. What does it look like? Scratch that. What does it feel like? Look at it with the eyes of the art.
A bright light. Looks and feels like power.
Power?
Feels like the art.
Art doesn't affect art, Mawandule. If what you say is true, they are trying to burn a fire or flood an ocean. It won't work.
Father, Jared says the dragon is the art, and the art can't damage itself.
The Fane glanced at Mawandule, his eyes losing confidence. Once more, he set down his wine and stood up. The beast was crossing the chasm, wings beating in a steady rhythm, tail straight out behind it. Larger and larger it became.
How big is it? How can that be the art?
The Fane took a step forward and cast off his cloak. With a hum and a wave of his arm, the Fane sent forth a blast of fire that coursed across the sky, striking the beast in the chest. The flames did nothing, and the monster appeared to swim through the blaze. Then, as if given the idea, the dragon opened its mouth and replied in kind. A blast of fire shot from its mouth at the hill. Instantly, the flame wall marching toward the Gula vanished when the Miralith abandoned it in exchange for creating a means of protection. A defense screen was one of the first things a Miralith learned. The crossed arms and buzzing sound became as much a reflex as throwing out one's hands in a fall. Mawandule put up his own shield, so did his father, and Sign threw up a defense over the Fane. But the spiders, by virtue of their training, reacted differently. They combined their efforts, creating a small dome that capped the hilltop. In doing so, they saved the lives of those few servants lucky enough to be standing close by, including Treya, Tirana, and his 12 lions. Everything on the command hill was scorched black, including a dozen tents, a cask of wine, travel packs, linens, tables, torch stands, 5 soldiers, and 2 dozen servants who didn't have the time to scream. When the fire was exhausted, Mawandule looked up and saw the dragon was huge, the size of a building, a big building.
Knock it down! Throw it away! Use the wind! Only wind!
Anya nodded and the spiders reconvened their weaving.
Just channel the natural air, like when combating the Orenfar.
The light breeze wafting across the hilltop died. Smoke that had been blowing away hung in the stagnant air as all around them grass continued to smolder. Overhead, a monster so big it blocked out most of the sky folded its wings, extended claws the size of swords, and dove.
No!
A massive roar came from everywhere as an incredible blast of wind hit the beast and sent it spinning away. The dragon became a leaf in a hurricane.
Did it work?
Mawandule was too scared to be obstinate, too relieved to be vindictive.
Yes, the wind threw it back.
In that brief gap, in that moment left open for taking a breath, Mawandule heard the clash of battle. Everyone had forgotten Gula. With the firewall gone, the horde ran at the Shadi with a new fury. They shouted and yelled so that their joined voices created a roar similar to the howl of wind the spiders had harnessed. They charged across the scorched and smoking field and slammed into the remainder of the Fane's army. The blue and gold warriors were immediately swamped by a sea of runes. There would be no possibility of erecting a new firewall without killing their own soldiers. This wasn't much of a problem. The real concern was the dragon. With the first wind expelled, the spiders drew another breath. The beast wasted no time flying back toward them.
Drive it down this time. Slam the dragon to the ground. Crush it.
The beast was fast and only a few hundred yards away when the spiders struck it from above this time. The dragon hit the ground so hard it bounced and left a long scar in the field. But the fall didn't kill it, didn't phase it. And a moment later, the monster was up, this time running toward them.
Blow it back! Blow it back!
The beast was too close. The spiders couldn't recover in time. Mawandule felt a sudden surge.
Help him! The spiders are out of power! Help your father!
Mawandule didn't have much experience with wind, but it wasn't too difficult, not with the force of Avampartha fueling him. He could have been way off, casting the most inefficient of weaves, which he was certain was the case, and yet the sheer force was capable of sending the beast hurtling backward once more. Heads turned to look his way, but no one wasted the time to make a comment. Instead, Anya faced the Fane, shaking her head.
My Fane, we can't kill it.
Tirana, who up until then had remained silent, turned to Lothian.
My Fane, the battle is lost. You must retreat.
He waved to the groom to bring horses.
No, not again. Not when we are so close.
My Fane.
Mawandule thought it might have been the first time he'd heard Sign.
The Shadi are engulfed by runes, and that beast can't be stopped. You and your son must flee.
This is my whole army!
And they will die so that you can live.
Mawandule couldn't help noticing that the dragon was coming back. Once more, it had taken flight.
Mawandule, can you blow it to the ground?
Say yes.
Yes.
Good. Do that.
Sign faced the Fane.
I have an idea that might buy you some time.
She meant for his father to escape. Mawandule couldn't help but hope he was included in that plan. The beast came at them faster this time, more determined than ever.
Do what she says.
Sign looked at Mawandule, and in that instant she spoke 1,000 words with her eyes. All of it came down to one simple idea. Don't miss. The surge filled him again. Mawandule felt void, rich with strength. He was the Partholoran Falls. He was a torrent, a great river running in freefall. He was powered. On his second try, he heightened his wind weave, made it cleaner, less ugly, and brought the downdraft hard. The dragon slammed onto the field once more, unfortunately on a section where the fighting was thick. The impact killed a score of Frey and runes. But again, the beast was unfazed. The moment it hit, however, the grass came alive. Deep, long roots and a million stalks grabbed hold of wings, feet, and tail, looping, swirling, wrapping.
You've trapped the thing! Signed, you're a genius!
It won't hold. Spiders, join in!
It's only grass.
Sweat was beating on Sign's forehead.
The creature will break free. Open the ground!
A moment later, the plain of rock and soil split apart and the beast fell. As Anya clapped her hands, the ground closed, swallowing the beast.
She's buried it!
That won't stop it. You need to get out of there.
Down the slope, Mawindule saw far fewer Frey soldiers defending them than there had been only minutes before.
My Fane!
Dorana gestured to a pair of horses being brought over.
You must go!
Lothian looked down the slope at his dying shoddy, then at the scar left where the dragon had been buried. Then they all felt the tremor under the ground. Something big was digging beneath them. Tirana turned to his aid.
Inform the Lion Corps. We are leaving. We are leaving now.
You go to, Sign. Protect the Fane.
We can't afford to lose this battle.
This is but one encounter, my Fane. It would be better to fight another day. As long as we have you, the campaign continues.
Mawindule saw the resignation in Lothian's eyes. His father had lost so much in that battle. Not just the lives of so many Frey, but his belief that the Frey were invincible. Mawindule feared he would see that look over and over in nightmares and on the faces of many others. His father, his Fane, was not invincible.
The Battle of Granford was not only the turning point of the war, it was a watershed for all of mankind. Those 3 days were our first steps out of darkness and into the light of a new dawn. Beauty and grandeur, the arts and sciences, and peace and civility all grew from seeds watered by the blood spilled on that terrible soil. Alon Rist remains but a ruin, a bluish stone rising out of a forgotten hill, but it was the beginning of everything else. The Book of Bryn.
Victory. The word was spoken frequently after the Battle of Granford, but never with the sort of enthusiasm or joy expected with such a term. For Persephone, it was a hollow word, made empty by the many holes cut through her heart. One hole for every life lost, the largest punched out by the death of the man in the grave at her feet. According to the most recent count, 2,833 people had died over the course of those 3 days. The death toll was expected to rise the deeper they dug. 1,806 were human, including Meryl, whom Persephone learned was a slave working in the keep. The man had taken it upon himself to murder the leaders of what he deemed the enemy. Meryl had avoided capture by hiding in the labyrinth beneath the Varenthanon, only to be killed by the very Frey he had sought to aid when they collapsed the Great Dome. 2/3 of the defending force of Alon Rist had perished. Persephone knew the number because she had Bryn keep an exact count as the bodies were recovered. In all her dreams, Bryn likely never anticipated this would be part of her responsibilities. By every account, the attacking Frey had suffered such a comparatively similar number of casualties that the battle could have been considered a draw. Expectations made all the difference. No one had thought they had a chance. So, by the fact that she was still breathing, the world judged Persephone the victor. Breathing was about all Persephone was doing. Standing between the two graves, she was having a hard time even with that. Her wounds were still debilitating, so her stomach was wrapped tight, and she'd been carried down from the keep. Here, she insisted on standing. They had come to say farewell to Wraith and Arion, and one did not sit in the presence of heroes. Each breath she took hurt, and the pain from her wounds didn't help matters. She was disappointed by the smaller-than-expected crowd.
There should be thousands, given what they've done for us.
But so many of those who knew of their contributions were also dead and buried on that terrible plain. Wraith had hated that place. Persephone now hated it too. Someone, maybe Bryn, had referred to it as the Field of Heroes. It sounded like her, like something she would put in her book. And while they were heroes, Persephone couldn't help feeling they were also victims. Her victims. More so than anyone, she was responsible. This was her victory. Tesh had dug Wraith's grave and placed the pyre stone, as was fitting for the next of kin. Persephone didn't know who had dug Arion's grave, but Suri had placed the pyre stone. Suri stood apart from the others, staring down at the twin mounds of rocks, as if unable to understand what had happened. Suri had saved them all. She'd also killed Wraith. No one had told Persephone this. No one needed to. The moment the dragon spoke, she knew. She knew more than she wanted, and it made standing in that dry wind trying to breathe so very difficult. Gifford made an effort to comfort Suri, putting an arm around her shoulder. She pushed it away.
Don't! Don't be nice. Bad things happen to people who love me.
As always, Bryn stood beside Persephone. She needed to record the event, but she couldn't have seen much through her continual tears. Moya, Tekchen, Padira, Malcolm, Frost, Flood, Rain, Roan, Gifford, Habet, they all showed up to pay respects. Tressa was the surprise. The widow of Conniger usually kept away from crowds.
I made it extra deep, then used the biggest, heaviest rocks I could find. Don't want animals digging him up.
Tesh wiped his nose and eyes. Bryn moved to his side and, taking his hand, squeezed.
We should say something.
To her surprise, Tressa, holding a rock in her hand, stepped forward to place it on the pile.
Not you.
Give it a rest. We just finished a battle. Haven't you had enough?
Of you, yes.
Tressa shook her head.
I didn't come here to fight.
Why are you here?
Tressa pointed at Wraith's grave.
I wanted to say something to him. Funerals are where people do that, or so I've heard. Do you mind?
Yes, quite a bit, actually.
Good.
Tressa grinned. The shield took a hurried step toward her.
Moya, let her talk.
The Keenig's voice was soft and weak, but the effect was powerful. Moya stopped abruptly and continued to glare. Tressa ignored her and looked down at Wraith's grave.
I didn't know you very well. You were Dorian, troublemaker. Knew it from the moment you first came to Wren. Dorians are nothing but lawyers, drunks, murderers, and thieves. Everyone knows that.
All of them glared at Tressa, and Moya began rocking on the balls of her feet, glancing over at Persephone, hoping for the leash to be removed.
Thing is, most people don't know Tet, just think they do. People always think they know everything about a person.
She glared at Moya, then stared back down at the pile of rocks at her feet.
You were Durian, so you had to be trouble. And maybe you were, but I never saw it. You cut wood for us when everyone else was too scared. Faced the fray when no one else would. Turned down the chance to be the Keenig, to rule over everyone. Never saw a man turn down power like that. Conniger wouldn't have. Conniger got himself killed trying to get one tenth of what folks were shoving in your face. And then... you. Then you go and do this. Damn lousy Durian, rotten troublemaker. I wish we had more like you, for that I would have had the chance to know you better. Because people... well, I guess people just don't know Tet.
Tressa looked up then. She glanced at the rest of them.
That's it. That's all I have to say.
She placed her rock on Wraith's pile and turned away. Moya relaxed. Her shoulders drooped. Her arms unfolded. Finally, she looked at Tesh.
Tesh, do you want to...
He shook his head.
I already spoke the words I wanted to while I was piling the rocks.
Moya looked at Persephone, who rapidly shook her head.
Suri?
She was looking at the Gilarabruin. The behemoth was curled up on Wolf's head, watching the proceedings with casual indifference.
Suri, do you have anything that you want to say?
The mystic shook her head. Moya looked to the dwarves, but they also declined.
Malcolm?
The tall, thin man, dressed in clothes Bryn's mother had made for him, stood before the pile of stones and raised his head.
This evening has caused me to pause and think.
Malcolm tilted his head back and looked up at the slowly darkening sky.
With the passing of Wraith and Arion, I think there will be at least two new stars in the sky tonight.
He looked at Arion's grave.
And from now on, I think the name Arion should be another word for wise. For while she was compassionate, intelligent, and giving, more than anything, she displayed wisdom. One might suspect that comes with living so long, but I think not. She knew that from arrogance came apathy, from apathy came ignorance, from ignorance came hatred, and from hatred, well, nothing good ever came from hatred.
He paused to look across the bloody landscape.
She tried to stop this, but I think wisdom is rarely ever enough when fighting hatred. Sometimes sacrifices need to be made.
He focused on the other mound of rocks.
I think Tesh did a fine job with the stones. Big ones on the bottom, small ones on top. He also put a little one in your hand, Wraith, so you can enter Pyre. You would have approved. I'm sorry I had to mislead you. Then I'm sorry about a lot of things. Be sure to tell your sister and mother that you weren't like your father or brothers. You did something good. Something very good. And I think your life made a difference.
Malcolm looked up at the sky.
No, that's not true. This night has made me think many things, but that is one thing I know. Your life did make a difference. Sleep well, my friend. You've earned it.
Then Malcolm lifted his head and sang.
My love I give you, into Elan I send you. Forgive me, I beg you. Be at peace, I ask you. May whatever good is in this universe watch over your journey.
Malcolm then produced Herkimer's bronze medal, the one Wraith had worn ever since the two of them had met, and he placed it on the grave. He trapped it there with a rock and stepped back. Then everyone else stepped up, placing their rocks on both of the graves. Grimacing with pain, Persephone placed one on Arion's and then stepped back. She didn't go to Wraith's. This didn't go unnoticed by Moya.
The ceremony is now over. Return to your homes. And remember those we've buried here today.
Moya moved to Persephone's side.
Let's get you back.
No. I'm staying.
You can barely stand.
I need a moment alone.
Moya considered this, then nodded.
Fine. But I'll be waiting over there with the litter. Wave if you need me.
Come on, Bryn.
Why isn't Persephone coming with us? She needs a moment alone. Come on.
Moya and Bryn moved off.
Sorry?
Persephone stopped the mystic when she started back. The girl turned, her face drawn, eyes tired.
I want to ask, why Wraith? Of all the people, why was it him you sacrificed? Was it because of me?
The words caught in her throat, refusing to come out.
Never mind. I'm sorry. I know why, and I'd rather not hear it aloud. If you say it, I'll have nothing to hide behind.
It didn't hurt.
It didn't hurt him.
Persephone nodded. Suri walked away, leaving Persephone alone in the light of the setting sun and at the mercy of the harsh wind. She moved forward only a step. That was all it took. She fell, caught herself with her hands and knees. Pain ripped through her center. Moya started to come back, but Persephone waved her off. Then the keening of the 10 clans started to cry. She was stunned that she'd lasted this long, alone in that horrid place. Before that lonely pair of rock mounds, the dam broke. She let it wash over her. When at last she stopped weeping, the sun had slipped behind the ruins of the Rift, and stars were beginning to appear in the east. From around her neck, Persephone removed the chain that held the chieftain's ring, the one she had let fall the night she said goodbye to Reglan, the one Bryn had found. She squeezed it in her hand, feeling the metal cut into her palm.
I had to do what was best for my people. I had to. I still have to. And I know I hurt you, but damn it, Wraith, you hurt me too. And this was just cruel.
She wiped her face with her wrist.
I wish to marry that Suri had asked me before she asked you. If I had known she was looking for sacrifices, I would have stood in line all night to volunteer. Then I could be the hero and you could be the one drowning in guilt and self-loathing. Let me tell you, a painless death at the hands of Suri sounds like a pretty good deal right now. But I won't get to die a hero like you. Women never do. We just get old and then we're forgotten. Wraith, I wish I could say I was sorry, but I can't. I just can't because this just hurts too much. You took away my chance. You stole my one hope to make everything right. And honestly, at this moment, I hate you. I hate you so very much. Almost as much as I hate myself. So take it.
She moved to the mound of rocks, lifted one, and set the ring on the pile.
Nifrin gets everything else, but not this. It's yours. I think it always was.
Seth?
It was getting dark, and the shield was having trouble seeing her keening. Persephone waved, and Moya started toward her.
I have to go. I have to take care of my people. It's what a keening does.
Moya arrived and helped her to stand up.
You sacrificed yourself to save us. Good for you. But you only had to do it once.
In my mind's eye, I see this little bird flying past arrows, Miralith conjured lightning, and a fire-breathing dragon. What an unlikely hero. The Book of Brim.
Imali sat sideways in the golden chair in the center of the empty Arenthanon, with her legs thrown up on the arm, most undignified and disrespectful to the sanctity of the chamber. It was also wonderful. At her age, Imali's feet had a tendency to throb when she stood too long, and she'd just spent hours on them. The weekly meeting of the Aquila had ended, and the assembly had been vicious. Imali didn't blame them. She was anxious, too. The Fane and the army had been gone for weeks without word. Everyone wanted answers. She didn't have them, but that didn't stop the questions. As curator of the Aquila, she was acting Fane in his absence. This position held no real authority. The martial powers bestowed on the Fane by Feral did not transfer. She also had no authority to set policy. All she could do was oversee the appointment of a new Fane should the old one die, and as was the case just then, fail miserably at answering questions about Lothian's progress. Some of the questions, like the one posed by Minister Metis, were legitimate concerns for the Fane's well-being. More, like Valhorik's inquiries, were politically motivated. Like many, he saw a rare opportunity. The Fane and his heir were both at war. War was dangerous. Should something happen to them both, the field of options would be wide. The Aquila, and most especially Imali herself, would have the power to direct the future of Erevan. If they allowed only non-Miralith to blow the horn of Glendora, the Frey would have a new ruling tribe, one with the power to castrate the growing supremacy of the magic class. The course of history might be forever changed should the Fane and his son die. Volhoric was probing, seeing where her intent lay. He would, of course, want to endorse an Umalan for Fane. He said as much when he stated that the Frey were in need of strong religious leadership to help them return to Feral's fold. As self-satisfying as it might be to deflate the egos of the Miralith, who had indeed become too full of themselves, doing so was dangerous. The riot of the year before had proved that the Miralith might not dutifully accept a place at the back of the line. Handled poorly, no, even if handled well, Erevan could explode into civil war. She considered going to the garden to think, but she'd avoided the bench across from the door since her unexpected encounter with the unseemly stranger who announced he would be watching her. As far as she could tell, he hadn't been. She'd asked around and discovered nothing. Imali had gone so far as to send people to walk by that bench to determine if he was still there. He was. She found this both unsettling and reassuring. Yes, he was still around, but obviously not stalking her. Her initial thought that he might be a threat had faded over time. Now she wondered if she should have gone back. The fellow on the bench was an enigma that haunted her, but he was also a potential source of information. He appeared to know more than he ought to. Imali had been on her feet far past the usual 2 hours, and they were screaming at her because of it. Lifting them up helped drain the swelling. She'd take a soak when she got home in the hope that they would be recovered for the next week's assembly. She unhappily jerked her legs off the chair's arm. She didn't need Volhoric or Caban to see her lounging on the sacred chair. Little things like that had the ability to become big things when said in the right way to the wrong people. Only it wasn't Volhoric or Caban, nor any of the counselors. It was, most certainly, the last person Imali expected, and seeing that familiar face, Imali was both stunned and terrified. With hands clasped before her, Makareta entered the Erenthanon. The Miralith, who had seduced Mawandule into unwittingly aiding a revolt against his own father, walked across the marble floor. This is how these things happen, in empty, hallowed chambers when no one is looking.
I wonder if she's in league with the fellow on the bench. Both of them lying in wait. Both remarkably patient.
Imali was reminded of the broken leg and sprained arm Makareta had given her as a result of a magical toss across the chamber. It still hurt, still ached on rainy days. Yet Imali wouldn't give the child the satisfaction of showing fear. She sat up, brushed the folds from her assica, and smiled.
What brings you out of hiding?
I need help.
Only then did Imali notice the filthy state of Makareta's assica. Stained and torn in places, it looked more like a rag. And she had hair. Not just a bit of stubble, the result of lazy neglect, but locks that covered both ears and the back of her neck.
She has been in hiding. By the look of her clothes, she did most of it in a hole. I suppose you do, but why come to me?
You're the only one who might listen.
Why would I help? It's not like I have fond memories of our time together.
Because you're wise and compassionate.
The laugh came despite, and possibly because of, her fear. Terror had a way of making her overreact. The Miralith standing in front of her wasn't only incredibly powerful, but given that she'd already killed Frey, Makareta was no longer bound by Feral's law. She was a wanted fugitive, desperate and unchecked, and in her eyes Imali saw her own death. Having revealed herself, she couldn't allow Imali to live past the end of their conversation, whatever that might be.
You have me confused with Mawindule. Flattery won't work.
I'm not flattering you. Those aren't compliments, they're facts. I've watched you under this dome for years. You listen. You hear. You're fair, and you have the best interests of your fellow Frey at heart. You are the only non-Miralith I respect.
Imali still cradled her arm, out of habit.
Was it respect that caused you to fling me across this room?
Yes.
Makareta pointed at a marble statue of Fane Gicca. With a snap of her fingers, the statue burst into powder. Imali hated herself for flinching at the loud crack, magnified by the echoing dome. The point was clear. Imali looked at the dust and rubble that had once been a very fine depiction of Gicca. She felt she was taking her life in her hands as she made her reply.
I'm sorry, but I can't help you. I don't have the power. And I wouldn't help even if I did. What you did and what you tried to do were unforgivable, incomprehensible. We only just repaired the scars you left in this building and the square outside. Our whole society is based on the principle that Frey don't kill Frey. And most of all, that we revere the Fane.
Do you think Lothian is a good Fane?
Good or bad, he is Fane. There is nothing anyone can do about that. Besides, you would prefer a world where Miralith were gods and those like me were your slaves. I hope you can see that it's not in my best interest to bring about such a transition.
Right now, I'd settle for a non-Miralith Fane if that Fane didn't want me dead.
Makareta looked at her own feet.
Aiden, Renald, Inga, Flynn, Orlean, Tander, they were all killed or executed without hope of an afterlife. Flynn was kept alive by the art as his skin was melted from his body.
Imali nodded. The Fane had decreed that all Frey in the capital had to witness the executions. Imali had defied Lothian's edict, claiming illness. Having seen how he killed Zephyron of the Instaria during the challenge in the arena had been enough for her. Still, she had heard the stories. Dozens of people in the audience had become physically ill, and several had suffered nightmares for weeks afterward.
You're the curator of the Aquila. You have influence.
Imali noticed fear in Makareta's eyes. What stood before Imali wasn't a rabid dog. She was a frightened child, an orphan on Imali's doorstep. Makareta's face was pale, her eyes outlined by dark circles. She was thinner, too. The Miralith might be able to explode a marble statue, but she was wasting away.
Where have you been hiding? What life have you led for the past year that finally drove you to me?
I'll do whatever you want, whatever you ask. I'm actually a very skilled Mirrorleith.
She looked at the pile of rubble that had been the statue.
Ja, Nui'ir.
With a few words and a flip of her fingers, the powder reassembled back into the likeness of Gicca, as if nothing had ever happened.
A Mirrorleith without a tribe, without a friend. I thought such a thing might be of value to a Neliand, curator of the Aquila. Also, you owe me your life. Sort of.
What exactly do you want from me?
Macaretta licked chapped lips.
Right now? Food? And a safe place to sleep? Later, maybe you could make a case for leniency, or perhaps convince the Fane to stop looking and let me go somewhere far away where I can try to live. It's so hard to constantly block the searches. I can't even shave my head, it's disgusting.
A tear slipped down the girl's cheek.
I'm only 116.
She squeezed her lips tight, then wiped her eyes.
I don't want my life to be over before I've had a chance to do anything. I made a mistake, I know that, and I'm sorry. We were all so swept up. It was all so... I'm sorry.
Imali let her cry. The girl was a manipulator, but then Imali had spent nearly 3,000 years dealing with far more savvy ones than Macaretta. She got up, walked the distance between them, and put her arms around the girl. She gave the girl a hug while she cried into the curator's shoulder.
I'm so scared.
You should be.
The sound of footfalls came from the outside steps. Macaretta looked up, pleading.
Hide behind the pillar.
The girl sprinted out of sight.
What am I doing? Harboring a fugitive and a traitor to the Fane, no less?
She was still shaking her head when the Frey who made the stories came into view. Imali knew him only vaguely, a face seen on occasion. She couldn't remember the name, but the uniform said everything she needed to know. He was a courier from the Talwara Palace. In his hand, he held a dispatch. He bowed his head modestly.
A message.
Message? From where?
A bird from Alan Rist. Usually we would let it sit, waiting for the Fane's return, but it's possible the Fane sent it from there, and if that is the case, it would be meant for your eyes.
She took the sealed wooden tube encased in wax and cracked it open. The palace servant waited.
You may go.
He obviously wanted to know what was in the message, so he gave a look of disappointment before he pivoted and walked out. Listening to his fading footfalls, Imali drew forth the small bit of parchment and unrolled it. She read it three times before Macaretta emerged from the shadow of the pillar and approached.
What does it say?
It doesn't say the Fane is dead. In fact, this isn't from our forces at all. This appears to be from the enemy holding Alan Rist.
Macaretta appeared disappointed.
What does it say?
Imali crushed the paper in her hand and smiled at the girl.
It says, I could benefit from the services of an outlawed Mirrorleith who is willing to do whatever she is told.
Legends of the First Empire, Book 3, The Age of War, Part 2, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2018 by Michael J. Sullivan. All rights reserved. Recorded with the permission of the author. Production copyright 2019. The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication is prohibited. Performed by Terrence Aselford as narrator. Eric Messner as Wraith. Todd Schofield as Malcolm. Colleen Delaney as Persephone. Nanette Savard as Padira. Yasmin Toison as Moya. Thomas Keegan as Nifrin, Bradley Smith as Gifford, Jacob Yeh as Tesh, Amanda Forstrom as Suri, Kimberly Gilbert as Roan, Chris Stinson as Mawindule, Chris Gennebach as Lothian, Peter Holdway as Jared, Nora Ashrati as Bryn, and Jessica Lauren Ball as Arian, with Tracy Oliveira, Evan Casey, Michael John Casey, David Jordan, Tia Shearer, Lise Bruneau, Christopher Walker, Richard Rowan, Eva Wilhelm, Zeke Elton, Matthew Bassett, Christopher Sheeran, Andy Clements, Carolyn Kashner, Drew Kopas, Scott McCormick, Michael Glenn, Dylan Lynch, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Matthew Ward, Ken Jackson, Ren Casey, and Cameron McNary. Adapted for graphic audio and directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Casey Green. If you enjoyed Legends of the First Empire, The Age of War, be sure to listen to Megan E. O'Keefe's Scorched Continent series, along with our whole catalog of exciting releases at www.graphicaudio.net. And remember to check out the free Graphic Audio Story Podcast, or GASP, available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What Snorri told you was true. There were hundreds of them. Goblins everywhere. They led us into a trap and then swarmed us.
And hobgoblins. You saw them as well.
They were hobgoblins, all right. Tall as a man or taller, armed with hooked lances and swords. They had crossbows too, and they were riding camels.
Well, they sound like no hobgoblins I have ever known.
No, they do not.
Graphic Audio presents...
I found us gainful employment.
What do you mean employment? We've lost our cavalry commissions. We're still in debt to the Holy League. The only jobs waiting for us are in the frontier foot or pulling ropes on a river barge.
Marching in lines, bending oars. It's not for me, Cole, nor for you either. We're too good for that kind of drudgery.
A journey to the ends of the earth.
My God, is that a...
Yes, a dwarf.
He's the biggest dwarf I've ever seen.
You two could be none other than the mighty heroes the Waladid has told me about.
Who?
No, you're here to see the sorcerer.
A new epic fantasy from the imagination of Chuck Rogers.
My studies require extended travels, often to dangerous and uncivilized places. I must often travel quietly and lightly. I cannot afford to bring an army with me, so I must make up for lack of numbers with quality. Thus, I require the services of reliable and multi-talented men such as yourselves.
So, it is to be hired swords then, and doers of dangerous deeds.
Where do you go?
The Black Sea and beyond.
The Black Sea? What will you do there?
Yes, Orsini, what do you think we shall do there?
The world is wide, our swords are sharp, and our pouches full. We shall go wherever adventure takes us.
Add me a fruit stub!
Where magic is set loose upon the world, there is the road to desolation and the road to destiny.
I will tell you something my father told me long ago. He always said that there is only one man more foolish than he who gives his word to a wizard.
And who is that?
The man who breaks it.
Graphic Audio proudly presents Heroes Road by Chuck Rogers.
Thanks for listening to this Graphic Audio production. Graphic Audio has over 1,000 titles and 100 series to choose from in high-quality download formats. If you'd like to listen to an entire series, you can now conveniently purchase a download series set from graphicaudio.net. At graphicaudio.net, you can also earn loyalty rewards points redeemable towards future online purchases. You can stream or get full downloads directly to your mobile phone or tablet with our newly updated Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices. Listen to a movie in your mind, on the go, anytime, anywhere. For those of you who are new to Graphic Audio, check out our Graphic Audio Streams subscription service, where you can choose from four different genres. Each plan features two Graphic Audio titles per month to listen to through our Graphic Audio Access app. At the beginning of every month, the previous featured titles will be automatically removed and replaced by the new featured titles. It's an economical way to check out and sample titles from our various series in Graphic Audio, starting at only $4.99 per month. And be sure to listen to our newly reformatted Graphic Audio Story Podcast, GASP. Please subscribe, give us a 5-star review, and recommend us to your friends and family. You can get GASP in the free Graphic Audio Access app or subscribe to GASP through Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and RSS feeds. Sign up for our email newsletter for the latest updates and new releases, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter or Instagram. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net.